This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time.
Alice Pung is an award-winning writer based in Melbourne. She's the best-selling author of the memoirs Unpolished Gem and Her Father's Daughter and the essay collection Close to Home, as well as the editor of the anthologies Growing Up Asian in Australia and My First Lesson. Her first novel, Lorinda, won the Ethel Turner Prize at the 2016 New South Wales Premier's Literary Awards. 100 Days is her most recent novel. Alice spoke to me recently, and do excuse the sound of the rain that comes in about halfway through. Alice, it's such a joy to speak with you, and I feel very lucky because we've recently got to speak for the Yarra Valley Writers Festival, and now I get to speak with you again, which is just delightful. Welcome.
Oh, thanks, Kate. I feel very lucky.
We're talking today on the first day post Melbourne's fifth lockdown, and I just wanted you to let our audience know, because it's so delightful for both of us to have, I've got both of my children back at school, you've got one of yours, but you are actually talking to me, holding your gorgeous youngest, and you've got another one to sleep. Tell me, what is daily life like for you at the moment, Alice?
Oh, Kate, there's not much writing going on, but that's okay. I get to talk to you once I've carefully put them to sleep by walking around the block. Daily life is hectic, but I enjoy it. I like having the kids around. Yeah, I actually like being a mum.
I was just saying to you that I was listening to a recording, and I could hear your littlest one in the podcast I was listening to, and it was making me very clucky. So just a warning to anyone listening that if you hear little snuffly, delightful baby sounds, this is your warning. Don't get clucky. Alice, do you remember the first time you ever saw your words in print, as a child perhaps, or a student?
I love this question. Thank you. Not you know, to be honest, not many people have asked me this question. Yes, I do. So the first time I saw anything of mine in print weren't actually words. It was a picture that I drew of Michael Jackson, who I think I feel slightly differently about now, in 1994 for Smash Hits magazine, and I won a $20 Brashers voucher. It was, yes, the highlight of my year.
Brashers!
Yes, and they posted it to me. Oh, it was so special. That was my first publication experience.
I love that, Alice. And were you telling stories? I know, because we've talked about this, that you played a fairly major role in raising your siblings, and you mentioned when we were talking at Yarra Valley, reading stories to them. Were you telling them stories? Were you making up stories at that time as well?
Oh, yeah, I was, just because I like to read a lot. So, you know, so sometimes when my sisters were younger, I told them things that were probably not appropriate for their age, but I was good at reinterpreting things. So my sisters knew about Macbeth and Hamlet just because I was doing it at school as a teenager when they were around 5 or 6, but I simplify things a lot. So, yeah.
Do they have recollections of that? Like, as adults, have you talked about the kinds of stories that you were telling them?
I think they do have small recollections of melting into the earth and turning into a worm in Hamlet, and King Lear, Gloucester, getting his eyes pulled out. So, but they were great, because I realized you're never too young for Shakespeare, because my sister, who would have been just in primary school at that time, asked to see King Lear with me. So we rented the video. It was 4 hours. It was like, it was an adult thing, and it was a play, but she sat through it with me, and I thought, wow, that's quite incredible. She's very patient.
So you were reading Shakespeare and obviously those kinds of texts for school. What were you reading things like that for pleasure as well? What were you reading for pleasure at that time?
No, I was reading a lot of I wasn't, you know, precocious or anything. I did those for school. I read a lot of this wonderful author named Beverly Cleary, who passed away this year at 104. Mm. And, you know, Judy Blume and John Marston books, things like that, things that I could relate to as an adolescent.
I've referenced before in interviews the wonderful leaving address to the graduating class of Iowa that the writer George Saunders did, and I know it's often quoted. And when I was preparing for this interview, I found yours, Alice, to the graduating class of Melbourne Uni in 2008, and I think that it's wonderful. I feel like it should be shared, as George Saunders is. In it, you talk about your mother who worked as an outworker and your perception of how she might have seen you as her well-educated daughter, particularly as you moved off to university. And you say, she did all that for 17 years so I could end up at university. She emerged out of the shed at 40, arthritic, illiterate, with foggy eyesight, bewildered by the person I had become. I spoke and thought in a different language. I had filled my head with mostly meaningless words and irrelevant ideas. Through my mother's silence, I learned to listen, not to people's words, but to the actions and stories behind the words. This is perhaps why I write. And it's such a powerful image, Alice. And I wanted to ask, is this still, do you think, the reason that you write, to understand the actions and stories behind words?
I think so, Kate. Yeah, my mother's quite extraordinary. We're very close now, but as a teenager, I wasn't that close to her because, you know, she got on my nerves. I got on her nerves a lot. I didn't even speak the same language as her. She was 40 and she had a 17-year-old. I'm 40 now and I have very young kids. I can't imagine what it's like to deal with a teenager at the age I am. So she had a lot of forbearance for me. But she also had incredible insight that had nothing to do with being literate. So I remember because my dad read the Herald Sun at one point, and there was a personality test where you looked at photographs of six different people who were smiling for real or for fake. And my mum got them spot on, all of them correctly. So she has this great, she's a good judge of character. And because her life is not blocked by words, I think sometimes she sees things more clearly. Another example is I was in a furniture store with her and I was reading the labels of furnitures, and one was a, you know, Bauhaus 1970s vintage piece. And she looked at it, she goes, you can get that from the op shop for like $4. Why do you want to spend $299 on that? So, yeah, if you can't read, sometimes you see things as they are.
I love that. In that same speech, you go on to say to this class, many of you are going to make decisions that affect people who may not have the opportunity or ability to exercise their intellect. We have to realize the opportunity to freely exercise our intellects is a gift, not a given. And that really struck me, Alice. And I wanted to ask if you think that too many of us take this opportunity to exercise our intellect for granted.
Oh, I think we do, Kate. Just because I grew up with a community that you saw these talented men and women. Some had been doctors in their previous lives or engineers. One of my friend's fathers built the bridges in Vietnam, and in Australia he worked on a sewing machine in the back shed, you know. So we take it for granted. I also went to five different high schools, and I saw the sheer, there's no nicer way of putting it, the wankery that went on with people who didn't understand that they were very privileged, and it wasn't their fault. They were just young adults, but they were raised to rule the world, and they were raised to make decisions over people like my parents, or, you know, people who lived in the commission flats, as happened recently. And if you don't interact with people like us or the people that I grew up with, how do you make decisions for these people? It's just driven by ego. So I saw that firsthand, and it was quite disillusioning.
Alice, how do your parents see your decision to become a writer? And I know that that's combined with the fact that you are also a lawyer. Is that a role that they take great pride in, that you're a writer, or do they see that, as some other parents might, as something very risky to do?
Oh, I've always had a job alongside this, Kate, just because I'm cautious myself and I don't want to put all my eggs in one basket. Otherwise, that would affect my writing big time. I'd care about reviews. I'd care about earning money, you know, because I have a young family. So I've always worked part time in the law. And that's not only of comfort to my parents, but to myself as well as a writer. I don't think I have a lot of immigrant friends who are writers as well, who've never had the luxury of throwing everything in for our art. So that's just the way we operate, yeah.
So does that mean, I'm really interested in this, Alice, does that mean that given the opportunity that if you had were given all the time in the world to write, that you would just still decide not to?
Yeah, I think I'd still decide not to, Kate, just because I also need to live in the world in order to write. I don't write fantasy, science fiction or anything like that. Most of my fiction even is quite realist-based. So if I'm not living life, there's no life to write from, I guess.
So much of your work, all of your work probably, has at its heart questions and insights about culture and class and the way that these shape your characters and the context in which they live. And yet, and I hesitated both in writing this question, Alice, and in asking it, because culture and class, conscious or subconscious, is at the heart of what every writer does, but it's not a question that I ask all writers, particularly white middle-class writers. So I wanted, I suppose, to ask if it frustrates you that you've become something of a spokeswoman on these matters in your writing, and other that happens to other writers as well, or do you relish the opportunity to try and center stories that kind of continue to be marginalized by mainstream lit culture?
Oh, Kate, no, it doesn't annoy me, and it doesn't, like, it's the opposite for me. I'm quite stoked that I get asked to talk about culture and class, particularly the latter, because when my first book came out, I was always talking about culture, ethnicity, that kind of thing. But to talk about them in combination is so important, because I'm middle class now. You know, everything I do is quite middle class. And yet, you know, you don't, I have this understanding of what it's like to be from a working class family, to have one parent who can't read or write still, and who's, both my parents still work in retail. I think many Australians are like that. You go back one or two generations, you don't find very guilt roots or anything. So I just don't understand why we don't talk about class more. My friend Emily Maguire, who writes wonderfully about class, every single book she has is about class in a very nuanced way. She got me onto the American short story writer called Grace Paley, who said that every good story for adults should have a combination of two things. It should have blood and money in it. Blood in that our relationships and our kin, and money, you know, the certain economic arrangements that make it possible for us to do what we do in the world. And I think a lot of middle-class writing doesn't have that, not because they deliberately leave it out, it's because it's irrelevant. They don't have to talk about money that much. Yeah.
Something that I have continued to think about after our conversation at Yarra Valley, and we were both speaking on motherhood to a certain extent, you in 100 Days and me about my book, and you talked about how you had so much anxiety and powerlessness as you were doing that work of raising your siblings as a young person, so that by the time you came to first-time motherhood for yourself, you didn't have any of those feelings anymore. And it struck me what a class-based kind of notion it was that I presented the story of middle-class mothers who are so overwhelmed by first-time parenthood when they come to it, and how different that was. And it has struck me, and I've continued to think about it.
I'm glad you raised that, and I have a lot of empathy for middle-class parents who are going about this for the first time, motherhood, in your 40s or in your late 30s, when you've had complete control over your life, when, you know, at work you have deadlines, when you're parenting there is no deadlines, things happen all the time. So this position of almost complete control over your life, you know, you're empowered, you're an adult, and suddenly you're at the beck and call of a newborn. That's a huge shift. And I guess it just wasn't that big a shift for me, because I, you know, helped raise my sisters from a very young age. So I experienced all the anxiety, the, you know, the heart pounding scare of them swallowing a rubber band or just falling off the bed. And my mum, who was always working in the back shed, you know, a lot of people don't understand when they see mothers yell at kids in supermarkets, that these mothers are probably really stressed out and working class. You know? My mum yelled the most horrible things out at us. And when my sister fell off the bed once when I was supposed to be looking after her, my mum just ran into the house and said, "What have you done? You've made her retarded. You're dead if your sister's retarded." You know, there was no sitting me down. And I was so scared and anxious. And I took some oleander flowers because I knew they were poisonous when my parents were in hospital. And I thought, I'm going to kamikaze. I knew that word from a book. I'm going to kill myself if my sister's not well. And I was 8 years old at this time. And I had that in my mind. And my sister came back and she was fine because babies fall off and they're not brain damaged, you know. But I just remember having that thought. As an adult, I think, oh, you know, if I judge my eight-year-old self through an adult lens, that's a big psychological red flag there. You're 8 years old, you're thinking of topping yourself. But from the eight-year-old's perspective, it's the most logical thing to do to your parents killing you or you suffering for the rest of your life because of this terrible calamity. So I guess that was what I was dealing with day in and day out, especially during the school holidays. Mm. So when I had my kids, Kate, I was in complete control. I had finances. I had a loving husband. So I can completely understand middle-class mothers panicking in exactly the same way I did as an eight-year-old. If their baby fell off the bed, I can imagine you would think about that. You think, oh, my life isn't worth living, you know.
It's one of you telling those stories, Alice, is one of the things that I think makes you such an extraordinary writer is your capacity for empathy and to see things from those other eyes and not to judge them. I want to talk really specifically about your novel 100 Days. And in fact, Catherine and I both referred to it in the last episode of the podcast. And I said that I thought that it was a masterclass in voice and technique. And I'm not the only person who said that. Maxine, I noticed Beneva Clark has said that there is no word that is out of place. So I want to spend a little time asking you about how you created Karuna and the world of this book. Where do you begin when you start a new project? And what does it look like when you begin something like 100 Days? Is it an image or a note in your phone or a scribbled sentence on the back of a receipt? What does it look like?
Oh, okay. It's all those things because I write on the run and I write in the car and all sorts of things. But Karuna came to me the beginning of the book. I knew this girl would be quite trapped and it would be a very claustrophobic book. I'd only have 4 or 5 characters to work off. And quite early on, I knew the ending. I knew exactly where I wanted her to be and the relationships that she would maintain in her life and those that she would not have, importantly. And then it was the middle part of the book that took 4 years to to fill in. Yeah.
Okay, that's interesting. So a four-year process for you. You said there about quite claustrophobic. She is very trapped. She lives in an apartment building, Karuna, just with her her mother, who's referred to as grandma in the book. And there's not only a small cast, but that very claustrophobic setting. It's also written in second person. So in terms of technical limitations, you've given yourself quite a number of them. And I wanted to ask whether that assists you, I suppose, in your creative process in giving yourself some boundaries and framework, or if you did come up against them as blockages as you were writing for those 4 years?
Oh, okay. That's an excellent question. I didn't think, to be honest, I didn't think about these questions. All I knew was that it was a very character-based book. So I guess for me, characters come first. So Karuna had this very fraught relationship with her mother. And she has no one else in the world by which to judge what is normal, what is not normal, and what is superstitious and what is scientific in her pregnancy. So I thought that she would write a letter to her unborn child because they're co-conspirators against this great dominating force that is grandma. So that's why it's in the form of, you know, she's addressing her unborn child because she's got no one else in the world. She's locked up for those 100 days. So that was the literary device I used. And it is a device because no one writes letters with complete dialogue in them or anything like that, you know. Yeah.
The other extraordinary technique is that you've got these other kinds of narratives in there as well, fairy tales, and you've also got the work of the poetry of Walt Whitman in there as well. And they they work really hard, I think, the poetry does, and those fairy tale narratives as well, in highlighting aspects of the text. Did you always know they were going to be part of the story, or are they things that came in as you worked?
I think there were things that came in quite early as I worked. The fairy tale motif was pretty important to me because Karuna is essentially, she's a burgeoning adult. She's not a young adult. She's gone from childhood. Her mother essentially wants her to go into beauty pageants, you know, this idea of the princess that wins prizes and gets the prince in the end, because her mother's illiterate, grew up in abject poverty in the Philippines. So the only way out of abject poverty is through a fairy tale. You know, you win Miss World, as the Philippines did twice, or you play basketball. If for very poor people, they can't conceive of becoming a surgeon, or, you know, you aim towards the highest and easiest, not easiest, but what's achievable for someone of your class status. So that's where the fairy tales fit in. And Karuna subverts them, because, as you know, Grimm's fairy tales were pretty grim, and giving birth is pretty visceral. And the idea of Walt Whitman and Judith Wright is just because that's how I discovered poetry, through free book bins at the library. I was never formally taught or anything like that. Yeah. And I didn't want to deprive young adults in the Western suburbs this idea that they could exercise their intellect in this way. Hey?
Mm. I think it's really powerful. I also think, and I mentioned this to you only after we got to speak at Yarra Valley, but the idea of that kind of grand romantic tradition in a narrative, in certainly not in original fairy tales, but in some of the Disneyfied ones that we get now, and the way that you've subverted it, the way that Karuna subverts it. And I noticed that as a reader, even a reader who reads really widely, there was almost this kind of physical feeling in me when she rejects the kind of romantic narrative in the story. And I thought it was incredibly powerful in the way that you'd done it. As well, why was it so important for Karuna to be so independent in the end for you?
Oh, okay, because she's the realist. You know, her grandmother is almost the one who's idealist, thinking, I've got this child, she's got fair skin, she's going to be Snow White and get us out of this predicament, you know, and marry well and then have a happily ever after story. Karuna's just... one of her defining traits is she's quite a realist throughout the whole novel, even when she has a best friend who's quite idealistic and into Walt Disney princess. Mm. Just because her life has not shown her anything other than disappointment, you know, but she's not jaded either. I don't think she's cynical or anything.
No, she's not cynical at all. The language in all of your work, particularly in this book, is so spot on. And I think some of it's to do with specificity and the feeling as a reader that you have chosen the most perfect but also the most surprising word. And there's a bit, and I hope you don't mind me reading it back to you, that really struck me. And it's when Karuna, during the section where she's describing birth, I won't read it all, she says, "Oh my God, at Christ our Saviour, the nuns told us that Eve ate the forbidden fruit and created suffering. I feel like I've swallowed a whole orchard, stems and all, and it suddenly come to life, trying to break through my stomach skin, the appley nubs of your nudging limbs, the grapey hernias, the durian sharp spikes of pain." It's so good. It's so good. And it's so good, Alice, because those fruits have been brought in earlier and you bring them out again then, and it's kind of like when you're reading a thriller or a crime novel and you get the reveal and you think, oh gosh, that's good, that's really clever. So I wanted to ask how instinctive your language choice is for each project, or if you are kind of thinking about a tone or a style that you want the book or the voices to be in and collecting words that way.
Oh, that's a good question, Kate. I don't know. I wish I could give you a good answer. I don't think, I don't know how to answer that, but the fruits were just fruits that were denied Karuna by her superstitious mother. Pineapples could cause abortion, watermelon could give you cold fever, you know, all sorts of things. So they had to come back, because when you're giving birth, sometimes it does feel like there's a whole orchard of branches and nubbly apples in there. And also Adam and Eve had to come back because she's a lapsed Catholic. She left her private school because her dad would no longer pay for the fees. So it all comes back to that, her very minimal knowledge about these things, even about contraceptives. So everything relates somehow. I hope that makes sense.
No, it absolutely does.
Yeah.
You put the reader, and I'm assuming you intended to do this, you put the reader in a really difficult position because at times when Karuna reaches out for help, we're really gunning for her. Like, we really want the principal at the school to help her and to see what's going on at home. And yet there's another section where people from the Department of Health come. And I felt really torn as a reader. I wanted them to look after Karuna and to help her. But I was also nervous about her being taken away, or the threat of her, of course, of her child being taken away. Tell us a little bit about what you were trying to get at with those tensions.
Oh, of course. That's a great question. And I love being asked this because what happens to a certain demographic of people is you're simultaneously scared of outside intervention, especially if you're an immigrant. But if you're a young immigrant child, you welcome that. And your family exists on the cusp of, you know, this book has the most divisive reviews I've ever got. Some people say, oh, that you can feel the thick love pouring out of the mother. And other reviewers say, look, irregardless of what culture says, this is abuse, full stop. Karuna's mother never quite crosses the line of what we legally would call abuse in order for Department of Social Services to yank her away, or for even her school principal, who is very understanding of different cultures, to do anything about her. So is it abuse or is it not? That's the question that I leave up to the reader. And what's so interesting is that, you know, I knew someone who lived in a block of flats in Footscray, someone I liked a lot, and they actually called the cops on an 8-year-old boy who just was happily playing his Game Boy and his Nintendo every day during school holidays while his father worked in a factory, you know. So they called the cops on this boy, and eventually, shortly afterwards, this single dad and his boy moved out of the block of flats. But I thought, wow, if you're home all day, why don't you just invite that 8-year-old kid over? He's no danger to you, you know. Yeah, so sometimes when you call the cops on someone, the dad is just doing his best, and that's what I wanted the reader to feel. Oh, this mum is working two jobs. That's why she's locked her daughter up, so that her daughter can't get up to any more mischief or hurt herself, you know.
Mm.
Yeah.
When you're describing those kinds of situations, and I know you didn't write this book as a any kind of commentary on lockdowns or community or the kinds of divisiveness that we may be experiencing in our community right now, but do you think that there is a separateness and a division in community that happens now that stops people from reaching out like that and asking the 8-year-old kid if they want to come up and play? Do you think that's changed or it's different in different communities?
Oh, it's different in different communities. I think a lot of the people in the housing commission flats, in where a lot of my relatives grew up, and even to this day you read about it in the newspaper reports, they're quite close and they help each other out as neighbours. So it depends on what community, but there's always been a reluctance to interfere with certain cultures or certain things that, you know, that you think might be culturally specific. And that's where it gets interesting, Kate. So the mother is what we would consider verbally abusive to her daughter. She calls her all manner of things, including retard. And I had an English teacher write into me, really disappointed because I used the R word, saying that it should be explained and it should be, every time it's used, you should have a passage condemning it. And I thought it was used in context, you know, a mother abusing her child.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, there are whole pockets of communities where parents speak to their kids like this. You just can't understand them because it's not in English. And that kid might think it's okay to be called a effing slut or a frigging retard. And so, you know, I don't represent any culture, but the ugly side of it has to be in there as well. Yeah.
That's interesting, Alice, because I wonder if you are policed in a way as a writer in a different way than other people are, and partly because your works are taught so much in schools, your fiction, your nonfiction, that you have been for so long a writer who is present and engaged with young readers. Do you think that changes the way people, like an English teacher, for instance, writing into you might relate to, and the expectations they might have of your work?
Yeah, I think it does, Kate. That's a really interesting point. And I did, even when I wrote that R word, throughout the whole, you know, the whole editing process, about 1 year, I put it in, took it out. I thought, no, it has to stay in there because I have to honour the truth of these characters. And it's up to the English teachers and the librarians to actually go through a text and say why it's wrong. It's not up to the author to be didactic, because students know when you're trying to force a message onto them. They hate works like that, you know. So I had to keep it real. And that's the only way you convey an emotional truth of a situation. A lot of people don't speak nicely to their kids. And it's not only a cultural thing, as I mentioned again, it's a class thing. Yeah, I grew up with parents who were so what you consider really verbally abusive, and that was normal.
I want to talk a little bit about writing for young people. Your book, Lorinda, is marketed as YA, and you've also written for younger readers as well in your Marley series. Your nonfiction, as we said, is studied by high school audiences, and you've also written a book about one of the most famous writers for young people in this country, John Marsden. Can you just, let's start this by telling me what the connection is with John Marsden and why he continues to resonate for you?
Oh, I think exactly what I was talking about before. His books resonated with me as a teenager, Kate, just because they swore the teenagers got up to some mischief. They were experimenting with sex. Some of them weren't nice characters. Some of them were not very enlightened. In fact, there's a young man in the book, Dear Miffy, who uses the F word 48 times in 20 pages, you know, and he sounded completely authentic with the boys with whom I grew up. And his Tomorrow When the War Began series was about war, and it was about young people fighting the enemy and getting up to gruesome deeds. And some of them were heroes and some of them were not. They were ordinary people. And some schools I went to, because I went to five different high schools, didn't consider those books of any merit whatsoever, full of sex and violence. But what was so interesting was a lot of my friends and I, refugee backgrounds, we love those books because they, you know, some of my friends came here on boats. Some of them were child soldiers. We're like, this is totally real. Why are you censoring this stuff? You know? Yeah, so that's my connection with John Marsden. Since then, we've become good friends. Because I don't know how he does it, and I'm not sure whether he's allowed to in this day and age, but he got into the mind of a 14-year-old girl, not just a boy, but a girl. Yeah.
Alice, how do you define the differences in your works for YA readers and adults? Because obviously 100 Days, Karuna, as you just said, she's kind of missed that liminal space between childhood and adulthood. She's kind of thrust from one into the next. But 100 Days is very much marketed as an adult novel. Do you get to make a decision in these readership things, or is it more what the publisher is doing?
Oh, my publisher is excellent, and they know how to market the book. I don't. I just write the book. And for me, there's no difference between a young adult and an adult in a book like 100 Days, because as I mentioned, I've grown up with young adults who've had the responsibility of adults twice or three times their age, you know, kids calling the phone company for their parents, kids dealing with their father's cancer because their father can't read and write. So these, to me, are people with adult responsibilities who just happen to be chronologically younger. On the other hand, I work at a university and I know some people in their late 20s who you might not trust to look after your child for, you know, they're lovely people, the smartest people in the world. And you think, where do we draw the line? Like, so I write books for young adults who are like adults, and I write books for adults who are like young adults.
I think what you show, and it's the same as you've identified in Marsden, and what I think is really evident across the YA community in Australia too, is an extraordinary respect for young people and the experiences they have as well. And I think that that extends to, excuse me, there's a wild storm happening outside right now. I don't know if you can hear it where you are, but it's wild where I am. I think that that shows in the way that you engage with young readers as well. So your website, for instance, absolute treasure trove for students, and I can see that it's been designed that way as well. What's your advice for writers who are going into high schools or whose work is being studied in terms of how best to engage with readers in schools?
Oh, Kate, thank you for mentioning my website. I'm quite proud that you noticed that. I'm so glad. But I think my best advice is write the work first. So don't think about the themes of identity and belonging, culture, bullying. Write the work and base it on characters and keep them real. And then you can form your website with teaching materials and, you know, things like that. But the characters have to come first. And the worst way to go about it is to have a theme and to have a message. The best way, I think, is to have a question which doesn't necessarily remain resolved at the end of the book, but it has to be a book that is not without meaning either. Mm. And the double negative is deliberate there.
In a recent interview, you said, and this is perhaps to do with time constraint for your writing process, you said that you've become more precise and, for instance, your sentences have become shorter. I wanted to know in what other ways your writing process or your writing has maybe changed or got better potentially since you started.
Oh, thanks, Kate. I'm sure you would have had similar experiences. You don't have much time to think in sentences, let alone paragraphs some days when your children were young. So your sentences are very short and your paragraphs are just two or three sentences. And you can see that in 100 Days, which is a direct contrast from Lorinda, where you had long meandering passages just about what a teenager is thinking at that given time about, you know, her family furniture or things like that. There wasn't that much time to do that with this 100 days. So the writing became more sparse and then more poetic as a result of becoming more sparse. So that was a effect of kids interrupt you. I can hear the storm.
I know, it's really wild now. You seem to be the type of writer who has both fiction, non-fiction projects, lots of projects on the go. Are you thinking about them and planning them a long way in advance, Alice, or do you just come, is it when inspiration strikes, you go for that new idea?
Oh, it's a little of both. And to be honest, inspiration doesn't strike that often. It's not like it strikes every day or even every half a year. So when it does, I try and make it into a project, which is why I have a few going on at the same time. And one of the good things about having different projects on is you can never give yourself the luxury of writer's block, because once you've ran out of steam for one project, you think, oh, I'll just work on the other one tomorrow. You know, I just don't have the time to sit around daydreaming, being stuck anymore. Yeah.
I love that. How has the editing process differed for you, Alice? I know that you're published for the most part through Black Ink. Do you have a different editor for your fiction projects and your non-fiction projects, or do you work with the same team on each one?
Oh, I work with different teams, but there's one constant, Kate, and that's my editor of 20 years, Chris Fike. I'm so lucky to have him. He was a young editor, and I was a unpublished author when we met 20 years ago. And he took a big risk on me, and he said, look, I learned my editing through editing early books such as yours. And, you know, he was very careful. One of the most loveliest things he ever did was to keep my voice intact in my very first book. All my life, Kate, I'd had English teachers correct my characters speaking. If they use the word use, y-o-u-s-e, they would say, don't do that, it sounds bogan. And that's true. The teachers wanted you to have a job later in life and not to sound like a hooligan, but he kept the integrity of the voice intact in a lot of my characters. And I was only 20 when I wrote one of the stories for my book Unpolished Gem, and reading back, it embarrasses me, but I thought, oh, you've kept that voice, the young person's voice intact. You haven't tried to make me sound smarter than or you know, more sophisticated. Yeah.
That's an extraordinarily long editing relationship. I didn't realize that.
Yes,
that had gone on. Do you find yourself now anticipating what he would say in terms of in your writing? Can you anticipate some of the editorial feedback that you'll get back, or do you still find yourself, I suppose, surprising each other in that editorial process?
Oh, I can never anticipate what Chris will come back with, not because he's full of unpleasant surprises, but because he's just such a brilliant editor that he'll know when I'm lacking something in the story or when I've overwritten something, because you really can't tell yourself sometimes. You work really hard on, you know, on a certain section, and then you don't work as hard on another section, and that section might be the section that is actually quite good. I can't tell. So he can. Yeah.
Is he your first reader, Alice?
Yes, he's my first reader and the first person I go to when I have basically a draft. I'll say, Chris, I've got a draft of this. And he's always been so encouraging. And he's never said, oh, this is quite a departure from what you've done before. So when I told him about 100 days and how it would only have four characters at the most, he said, go for it. Yeah.
Alice, it's such a joy to speak to you. I feel like you could have a whole podcast with Alice Pung and just on like a different chapter for everyone, and it would be a 10-part series, but we can't do that because that's not what we do here. Before I let you go, though, and onto your afternoon and back to the kids, you're such an experienced writer and no doubt you have, you know, a lot of wisdom to share, but is there a piece of advice that you can share for writers coming up behind you?
Oh, of course. I think the best piece of advice is to write with the integrity of your voice intact. When I was younger, I tried really hard to sound more sophisticated. And look, to be honest, a lot of young people do that, especially in high school. They try and sound like middle-aged 40-year-old men because I think that's what good writing is about. If you're a teenager, sound like a teenager. If you're 20, sound like you're 20. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. And I think it gives your writing a certain something that's trying to be what it's not doesn't. Hope that makes sense.
It absolutely does, and it's great advice. And before I let you go, can you please recommend for us a debut book from any time or any genre?
Yes, can I recommend two, Kate?
Of course you can.
And I'm reading. Oh, I'm so excited because I just finished this book that my sister gave me. My sister's a GP. You know, in the suburbs, and she gave me this book called Emotional Female by, you've got it right here. It's okay. So it's by a brilliant young surgeon.
Yes.
Yes.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
I read through the whole thing in a couple of evenings because I have kids, and I thought, man, I hope the world changes for the better because I have a daughter. I wouldn't push her into surgery. It sounds like a terrible, terrible profession, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does.
And the other book, which has a very similar name to your beautiful book, Kate, is called The Mother Wound, because your book is called The Mother Wound. Yes, and you've probably got that too, and you're probably...
It's not on my on my pile, but I haven't read it yet.
Excellent. Imani Halen, who I'm going to be speaking with next week, and I've just started that. But, gosh, what a powerful book it is about her... She was pregnant and then her father killed her mother while she was pregnant, and then she had to have a child without her mother being there. Yeah, it's a really wrenching book. So they're my two at the moment.
Alice Pung, it's such a delight to speak with you and to learn from you. Thank you so much for sharing stories with us today and for your beautiful book, 100 Days, which I hope everyone goes out and reads.
Thank you so much, Kate. Thank you.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.